Good morning. May it please the court. Apex Clayton is the general partner of a Missouri limited partnership that owns commercial real estate in Clayton, Missouri. At issue today are judgments that certain limited partners obtained for nominal and punitive damages on a claim that Apex breached a fiduciary duty to make cash contributions to them. The court should set aside these judgments for two reasons. First, under this court's decision in Peterson versus Continental Boiler Works, limited partners did not, as a matter of law, have a submissible breach of fiduciary duty or punitive damage claim. Second, even without considering Peterson, actual damages are necessary both to establish the tort's elements and to qualify for punitive damages. At trial, the limited partners requested and received nominal damages on this claim. They did submit evidence of actual damages in the form of unpaid cash distributions, but those amounts were already recovered as part of their recovery in count one for breach of contract.
What if they had only brought a fiduciary duty action and not a contract action? And assuming you're wrong that they didn't, assuming they had a breach of fiduciary duty action and they brought it, they could have recovered damages, right?
Well, here we say they didn't have a breach of fiduciary because there was a contract.
I understand, but your argument that they didn't have anything but nominal damages because they'd already recovered them. And
right.
Contract, normally you could recover under either one. You have actuals. You just don't get to take them twice.
They requested nominal damages. We went ahead and addressed the argument that the record reflects they did submit some evidence of actual damages.
Right.
And we said that those were not adequate to save this count, assuming they actually had a breach of fiduciary duty.
Why not? I'm asking you, since had they not submitted their breach of contract, assuming they had a breach of fiduciary duty, they had actual damages whether or not they were awarded.
It's very
and they got $1,000 on each two, which is not really it's not the $1 damage.
Okay. Well, I can address both of those points
Please.
In turn. It is just a very fundamental principle of law and how we prosecute cases in Missouri that you have to have your elements met for each count. Okay, so you can't double use the same damages for separate theories of recovery.
Well, don't you often submit both, but you just get one recovery?
You can, if you have overlapping theories of recovery, you can elect and do that. But here we have one where they had a what they call a breach of contract, or maybe it was specific performance, where it was a forced buyout claim. And that forced my client to buy their interest for the fair market value, which the jury determined, and all the evidence, their evidence, showed that any value which they had submitted on their breach of fiduciary duty claim, assuming one had existed, was already a subset of that recovery. Their experts said that any unpaid cash distributions, if they were not paid, they increased the value of their partnership interest.
So they were actually not damaged, was
your argument? Correct. Correct. Because you know, we've settled the rest of it. There's a stipulation. We've satisfied that judgment. They even got their attorney's fees on that. So they have been made whole on that claim, and so they cannot now use something for which they've already been made whole to satisfy a damages element for
well,
breach
the fact
of fiduciary.
That you paid it or settled it after the fact doesn't control whether or not they were able to submit it at trial.
Well, they still cannot get the benefit of both claims.
Judge
at the same
said,
time.
Can
they would have to have elected.
Well, can they submit both claims? And the court just does not allow them to have a final judgment for both amounts?
That happens that all
is
the time.
Big. Right, exactly. And so one has to elect your remedies. But they got it.
No, you elect which to collect on. You got to submit both. So you've got damages on both. You can only collect one.
Correct.
We've never said that means you can't get punitive damages or that it's only one becomes only nominal. That's a very different.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals has said that in a couple of cases, which we cited in our briefs. One, I think, was the Marquis, and there was a few others that said you have to get the actual damages on the claim that qualifies for punitive damages.
But here it's somewhat hypothetical because they could have submitted perhaps, assuming they could have submitted on both, they in fact did not submit their full damages on the breach of fiduciary duty. They asked for and got $1,000 each on each for each of them. Isn't that correct?
They still have to find...
Is that factually correct, that they got, that they didn't actually ask for their full damages for the breach of fiduciary
they
duty?
They asked for nominal damages.
And they got $1,000. Why isn't that damage? Why isn't that adequate?
Well, one has to have... Damage is an intrinsic element. Under this court's precedent and others, you have to show that you were in fact damages. They didn't because they got it through another claim. However, we can't transmute, even though $1,000 for nominal damages is more than what, you know, often it's $1. But everybody, that $1,000 award did not become actual damages.
Why not is my question?
Well, they said this is nominal damages. They agreed that the damages that they may have had for unpaid cash distributions were already recovered. They were saying we were avoiding an additional duplicative recovery, which they conceded that they didn't have any further actual damages in the case.
I want to take you back just a little bit.
Yes.
To the trial court dismissed the appeal as being untimely. Your opponents argue it's untimely. Would you address that issue?
Absolutely. The Eastern District obviously didn't get to the merits because they dismissed it as untimely. 5112020 permits us to take an appeal from a final decision in the case. In order to take an appeal from that, you have to have a judgment that has resolved all the issues of the parties. After the jury trial, the circuit court entered a document that it called a judgment that was dated June 25, 2015, but there was still a pending claim for attorney's fees, and there was no Rule 7401B determination. Now, in their briefing, the limited partners say that the fee request wasn't raised until after that was entered, but that's contradicted by the record. We had evidence at trial and also their own statements in the circuit court below, which we've highlighted on page 9 through 11 of our reply brief.
But it was not a part of your petition, the recovery for attorney's fees.
Yes, it was. Well, it was part of their petition. It was. They asked for legal fees, and under, Lucas Stucco, we show in our reply brief that meets this court's standard. I think that was an opinion that Your Honor wrote. That involves statutory attorney's fees, but it's been the same analysis applies to contract fees. And they requested legal fees and the elements for it.
Only in the prayer, not in the...
Right, and that's adequate. That's adequate under Lucas Stucco. That's this court's decision, again, in our reply brief.
What was the basis for their claim for fees? It was in the contract?
It was a contract,
yes. And then later on, after trial, when they asked for it based on the contract?
Correct. They also asked for it at trial, and then as we showed in our reply brief, they said this was discussed before trial. There was one of the plaintiffs asked for it.
Part making an equitable estoppel argument that they benefited from.
Absolutely.
Claiming at the trial level that
Absolutely.
They were entitled to fees, and now they're saying
correct.
They weren't.
Correct. That's correct. So the actual judgment was entered on October 26th. Apex filed a timely motion for JNOV within 30 days after that. It had filed an earlier motion for JNOV, but that was premature, and it was actually denied by the circuit court before the real judgment was entered. So at that time, the court could have only denied it as not yet ripe. Per Rule 8105, the actual timely filed JNOV motion was deemed overruled 90 days later, and we meet the timeliness requirements under that. We also have a fallback argument about an amended judgment being a new judgment for all purposes. However, I think the cleanest analysis is the one that I set forth, that we didn't in fact have a judgment until the October 26th. I want to talk about, we spent a lot of time talking about damages, but I think the easy answer in this case as to why plaintiffs cannot recover $2.8 million in punitive damages on top of having already been made whole for the full value of their interest, and that's this court's decision in Peterson, 1991, Judge Robertson opinion. That case involved breach of a stock restriction agreement. It establishes the proposition that there's no punitive damages available for breach of contract cases, with very limited exceptions that don't apply here. Peterson identified two exceptions. You have to have conduct that amounts to an independent tort apart from a breach.
They pled in their petition and they presented evidence of breach of fiduciary duty.
They did not. They pled in their petition.
They pled the conduct of Mr. Is it Novelli? that he had loyalty to another business entity, that he used the funds to, that they donated the lot, they used the funds.
Those are all not even presented at trial. We covered this in great detail in our reply brief. Those were all old things that, in some cases, they didn't even say was part of their breach of fiduciary duty case before the trial court. Some of them are very old. The statute of limitations here would restrict pursuit of claims, breach of fiduciary claims, until 5 years before the suit was filed. Some of that is just way old water under
the bridge. What do you say they submitted evidence, though?
What they did and what they pleaded, if you look back at their pleading, which we highlighted in both our opening brief and our reply brief, they say Apex breaches fiduciary duty by breaching Section 9.2A of the partnership agreement. That is alleging a breach of contract. That's specifically what they say.
But they incorporated all the prior paragraphs.
They argued it at trial. Their standard of care expert, Mr. Price, said that they breached 9.2A of the partnership agreement. Their damages expert said that their unpaid cash distributions, he said they were damaged in a couple of years, not all, but in a couple of years, because the way that he analyzed that specific provision of 9.2A of the partnership agreement, the calculations weren't done and there was some distributable cash in a few of the years that would have qualified under the statute of limitations. It was submitted in the instructions, and opposing counsel even said, I think our case was pretty clear, it's about unpaid cash distributions. I think it's materially indistinguishable from Peterson. Like I said, that...
You're saying whether or not they could have sued for breach of fiduciary duty for other breaches, the only thing they actually submitted was the same thing they submitted as a breach of contract, and it's
well,
still...
Well, they didn't... They pleaded it. They pleaded their breach of contract both as breach of 9.2A and then also the forced sale. They had the exact same conduct alleged in the breach of fiduciary duty at trial. They elected only to do the cash distribution portion for breach of fiduciary, but that is a contract claim. So I'd like to draw the court's attention to Peterson at page 904.
Counselor, you're out of time.
Oh, I'm over. I thought I had that much time left. I see it's going up. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Sure.
Everybody does it.
Good morning, Your Honors. The judgment should be affirmed. We have there's a lot of issues in this brief, so obviously I can't touch on all of them. But I would first like to touch on an issue which I'm embarrassed to say I did not include in our brief, but it is something that the court could consider sua sponte, jurisdictional. That is the failure to preserve the error. If you look at the record, you'll see that there was a motion for directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's evidence. There was no motion, and then defendant put on evidence. There was no motion for a directed verdict at the close of all of the evidence, which is a necessary prerequisite to preserve error. There was a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, but there was no motion at the close of all the evidence. I would refer the court specifically to the court docket, which is reproduced at legal file 11, which shows the sequence and shows no motion. Also, if you look at the transcript, starting at page 738 and 739, where Apex Clayton rests that we put on no rebuttal evidence, through page 767, where closing argument begins, there's no oral motion for a directed verdict, therefore there's no error preserved. As she said in her first point, their issue is submissibility. To present a submissibility case, you've got to make the motion. Some of your recent decisions on this area include Howard versus City of Kansas City, which is a 2011 decision, 332 Southwest 2nd, Southwest 3rd, 772, Sanders versus Ahmed, 364 Southwest 3rd, 1975, that's a 2012. And I believe most recent decision was Harrisonville, which is 495 Southwest 3rd, 738, at Missouri 2006. And I'm sure Chief Judge Fisher, you're familiar with that because you had dissent even broadening the scope of what's required in that motion. So that's the, I apologize for not including that in the brief. Sometimes you discover things when you're preparing for oral argument that you, how could I not have seen that earlier? Regarding the second one is the one we were talking just recently. Judge Russell, you brought up the issue about the timing issue. We lay it out, I think, pretty carefully. I don't have a whole lot to add on that. The June judgment was a judgment. At the time the June judgment was entered, the petition did not, although it included in the prayer the kind of routine attorney's fees requests that appear so often in every petition that has no basis for attorney's fees, there were no facts pled anywhere in the petition that was reported.
Opposing counsel's reply brief quotes from page 913 of the legal file and says that you said below in seeking the attorney's fees, plaintiffs did assert before and during the trial that they were entitled to attorney's fees under the partnership agreement as amended. Plaintiff Malek read the relevant contractual provisions into evidence. The attorney's fees claim was discussed in chambers and possibly on the record as well, both before and during trial. And you asked the jury to award attorney's fees, it says?
No, did not ask the jury to award attorney's fees.
But can you, why doesn't judicial estoppel apply here? You've gotten the benefit of attorney's fees because you said you pled it sufficiently that you should get it, yet you're now saying, oh, no, we didn't plead it, so you can't review it, and we get to keep it without it being reviewed.
We did argue that there was attorney's fees. I would point that this is one of those cases which happens so often where, in a sense, both parties argue the opposite of what they argued below. So
why do we let you do that?
That's your discretion, Your Honor. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I understand the argument, but I would note that in their response, the only time we say anything about amending the judgment is in our reply, which was well after 30 days from the judgment time. So that doesn't create a motion for a new judgment. And we can't create jurisdiction to amend a judgment. There's got to be an actual after-trial, recognized after-trial motion to allow
And they did say your motion for attorney's fees said amend the judgment to add
it doesn't.
Attorney's fees.
Our motion for attorney's fees did not say amend the judgment. In our reply, which was filed more than 30 days after the judgment was entered, there is, in the conclusion of that, it says to amend the judgment to add a paragraph for granting attorney's fees all. But that was after 30 days.
If in fact there was a claim for attorney's fees, no, there's no requirement that there be any valid after trial motion. It just is not a final judgment.
Right, Your Honor.
And so you took the position in the trial court that you had a claim for attorney's fees.
Yeah, we took a position in the trial court that we would file a motion for attorney's fees.
That you filed it, you've made a claim in your petition for attorney's fees, not that you filed a motion.
Well, in the petition, there were no factual allegations. And in fact, the subcontract, which had the attorney's fee provision, which was not the main partnership thing,
you claim that you tried the issue of attorney's fees, you presented evidence, and so if in fact we don't allow you to switch your position, then the original judgment did not dispose of all the claims.
Correct. I agree with that. If the attorney's fees were alive and something to be resolved, then June was not a final judgment. We think that there's enough here to say that it wasn't. But in any case, failure to preserve, and let's talk about Peterson, which obviously is the crux of the case. Peterson was inserted in as the opinion, excuse me, that case was first raised in the motion for judgment, for a directed verdict at the close of plaintiff's case. There weren't any pretrial motions, no motion dismissed for failure to properly allege or any of that. And Peterson doesn't control here. Peterson doesn't apply here. In Peterson, what you had was a situation where you had a minority partner, minority shareholders, father and son, who together owned 25%, and later they sold part of 20% of the shares of the company. They signed a buy-sell agreement, which provided that if they no longer worked, the company, they'd have to sell back their shares. And the fight was over, you know, what the formula was, what was the market value, blah. There is no fiduciary duty of a majority shareholder to buy shares from a minority shareholder who no longer works at the company. We have many, many companies in this country, in this state, in which people who used to be employees, got stock, aren't working there, they still own their stock, and they can't compel anybody to buy their stock. The only reason why the Peterson people could compel to buy the stock is they had a contract, this buy-sell agreement that required to be purchased. That's in contrast to here, where we have individuals who, after 31 years of investing in this company, and they didn't just make their initial investment of, I think combined their initial investment was $440,000. They made additional cash calls, there's one referenced in the thing, of another $100,000. They paid taxes on imputed income for most of those 31 years. And there is no reason to give your money to a general partner as a limited partner in an investment partnership except to get some money out at some point.
But you submitted, in effect, you could have maybe submitted other things that they didn't do, but you submitted based on the distributions and the lack of distributions, which was a breach of contract. Where is the independent tort?
That's exactly the point around. There are two different bases for distributions. There is a contractual provision, which was ignored by all the parties throughout the entire period of time. The evidence we put on trial by our witnesses, by former Judge Price, and so on, discussed distributions outside the context of that contractual provision. No, is there cash in the bank? Well, you had money to lend to his other company, therefore you might make distributions.
In effect, you're saying even if there weren't a contractual provision, it would have been a breach of fiduciary duty.
Yes, not absolutely.
But does that matter? I mean, all it was, what you did have a contract, and you said they breached it.
No, Your Honor, it does matter. The Leibowitz versus Dolan case is right on point. Now, that's not a Missouri case, that's an Illinois case, but you couldn't find a case that's more on point, except in that case, the general partner was fairer to his limited partners than
the
other.
So you're saying we should hold as a matter of law, every general partner has an obligation to distribute money that's acquired to the limited partners. That's always a breach of fiduciary duty. Because otherwise, how do we submit that?
Yes. What I'm looking for, so every other aspect of our case, we have Missouri case law we rely on that we believe is controlling and favorable to us. The one issue we don't is the notion of that does a general partner or a limited partnership have some type of fiduciary duty to make distributions to the limited partner?
I mean, wouldn't that necessarily depend on the circumstances? There may be reasons why you can't because...
Yes, of course.
So it can't be as a matter of law you do.
Well, yes, Your Honor. The matter of law is, no, the fiduciary duty is to put the interests of the limited partners first, right, to work in their best interest. Their best interest may not mean making distribution in every case. I know there are many times when everyone's interests are better served by keeping the money in, for example, and operating in a partnership. So you have to look on a fact-by-fact basis. We're not saying that every partnership in every year has to make distributions, but we're saying when you have a partnership that is generating profits year after year with office buildings that are fully occupied in downtown Clayton, newest buildings, highest rent buildings in the city, fully occupied, generating, based on the evidence, $12 million of excess capital over the course of the prior 12 years. That under these circumstances, where you are in fact imputing income to these people, making no distributions whatsoever.
Why weren't they damaged by that then?
I'm sorry?
I mean, why didn't you submit for the taxes they paid they shouldn't have had to pay? Why didn't you submit damages? But you said instead everything for the breach of contract makes us whole.
Well, so the fiduciary duty claim only covered distributions for us, all right? There's no fiduciary duty to buy out their partnership interests, just as in Peterson, there's no fiduciary duty to buy out the partnership interests. The contract had provisions that related to both the buyout, that was a special negotiated term, and there's also a provision regarding distributions, which was wholly ignored by the parties for 31 years with no calculus or anything done. The evidence was that if you make distributions, that money's going to come out, and ultimately the value of the partnership is going to be a dollar for dollar.
So how was your client harmed by the breach of fiduciary duty you're alleging?
Well, I don't call the case, but we cited it, but I think it's in a footnote where it says, you know, when you're put through this rigmarole for years, there's damages just from that process, from not having,
but
I believe that was the Aloy
case. You didn't ask for those damages.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You didn't ask for those damages, and you didn't submit on those damages.
Well,
you submitted on the damages from the contract.
We did not submit for damages in the contract. What we submitted on count one was a valuation of the partnership interests. We didn't ask for damages. Said, what is the value of these interests? And the judge then entered essentially a judgment of specific performance requiring us to hand in our interest in exchange for those dollars. On the second count, we said, here's the evidence of how much we were damaged. But because the amount of distributions are ultimately going to end up being part of value to avoid duplication, which would then...
So again, you're saying the only damages were the distributions. You had no damages from the breach of fiduciary duty?
No. The distributions are the breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honor. Our position...
But you're saying it netted out because then the partnership...
Well, It became part of the value of the partnership. The money that wasn't distributed remained in, and therefore is part
so
of the value.
So you weren't harmed by it?
We were badly harmed.
I mean, I
harmed,
understand. Yeah, you seem to, again, be trying to have it both ways. I mean, what was the damage you're saying resulted? I'm not saying you couldn't have shown damage, but what did you – I'm not clear that you submitted anything other than the failure to make the distributions, but you're saying that the value of the partnership went up by the same amount, so I'm unclear where you're saying you were damaged.
As I recall,
the jury could have found.
I think the case that I cited on this particular issue was actually a Maryland appellate decision.
Well,
it's
really
case.
The facts what you
and what they say is, yes, even if at the end of the day you got the money wrapped up in the purchase price of the partnership, you were still damaged by the gross inconvenience the general partner put
but
you through.
But did you submit that to the jury or argue it to the
jury?
Oh,
yes.
Is that how
we argued that.
That's what I'm asking you. What did you argue on that point?
We argued that the entire practice for 31 years was to oppress these limited partners, to place them in a position to squeeze them out by giving them all of this taxable income with no cash to pay for it, in an attempt to snatch away their percentages of profit. We showed that about 17% of the limited partners had been
squeezed
out.
Well, that was for punitives, I presume.
That was for punitives. And
what
we said,
about for actuals?
They were damaged. I said, here's the amount of money they should have received in distributions, but don't award them, because there's another case that says if you show the damages, but voluntarily ask for it not to be awarded, and you get nominal damages, that's sufficient for punitive damages. And that's what I did. I said, here's all the money that should have had distributed to them. You know, if you award that, it's going to put the court in a position of having to work out the overlap and eliminate that. So make it easy. Award them nominal damages to show that they breached this fiduciary duty and find that we're entitled to punitive damages.
So what case is that?
Which one, Your Honor? I've mentioned several.
No, the case you just cited for that proposition.
That you can voluntarily...
I'm just asking for nominal damage.
That is a Missouri decision, and
it's cited for that in your brief?
I cited for that in my brief, and I'm sorry that I can't tell you right off the top of my head. I'm sorry. There's a lot of cases in this brief. I have 38 seconds left, so I think the easiest thing is simply say nothing was preserved, and they're out of court. That's always the easiest solution. The next important thing is, is there fiduciary duty on the part of a general partner to make distributions when it's in the best interest of limited partners and the right circumstances, and can that duty be violated? That's a new issue for Missouri. I think the Labovitz versus Dolan case is very clear. That case has been filed in a lot of places. We've cited some of those cases, and I think that's a just rule. You don't give your money to someone for 31 years in expectation that you never get anything except tax bills. Thank you, and I ask you to affirm the judgment.
Counselor?
Yes.
Did you make a motion for directed verdict based upon lack of sufficiency of the evidence at the close of all the evidence?
This issue came up in an oral argument at the Eastern District, so I spent a lot of time looking at preservation. He chose not to address it in his brief, in a substitute brief in this court, but I want to draw the court's attention to, obviously, we raised the Peterson issue in the motion for a directed verdict at the close of plaintiff's evidence. That's at 533 to 537 of the legal file. Counsel made the same point after close of all the evidence. This was in the instruction conference, but it was orally made as a statement that there was not a submissible case. That's at transcript 759 to 760, and we quoted that in a footnote at our brief on page 18. Mercel versus Farm Bureau and Country Insurance of Missouri, I didn't cite this in the brief, but at 396 Southwest 3rd, 467, the Eastern District found an oral motion at the close of plaintiff's case that referenced previous motions, followed by an oral motion at the close of all evidence was identical, was sufficient to preserve the issue. And the point of the rules is to apprise the parties in the court of an issue so that it could be addressed at the earliest opportunity. This was, everyone clearly knew that Peterson was an issue, the lack of having a viable breach of fiduciary duty claim was an issue.
Was your motion for a directed verdict at the end of the case on the record?
It says it's at transcript 759 to 760, so he says it was Peterson, they didn't have a submissible case. He didn't use the word motion, but it was clearly understood at the time.
Well,
my
point was in law school you had to make it at the end of the plaintiff's case, and then you had to make it at the end of the entire case. And then in Harrisonville, this court said, well, it's good enough to bring it to the trial court's attention when they can fix it if there's a motion for directed verdict, either oral or written, at the close of all the evidence. So
right.
there might be all sorts of stuff right. said at an instruction conference, or there isn't evidence to support that.
Right.
But was there a motion for directed verdict, your oral in writing, at the close of all the evidence?
They did not use the term motion.
But you're
saying that failing. Now, I have another point that I want to bring to your attention on this, and that we cited, assuming the court, I think that's the way he couched it was sufficient to raise it. However, assuming the court says the term motion must have been used, the challenge that we have to the punitive damages point is still properly preserved. Because
they didn't use the term motion, did they use the term directed verdict?
Did not, Your Honor.
But you said failed to make, they did use the term no submissibility.
Submissibility. He said submissibility, he said Peterson.
Well, that's submissibility goes to instructions given, too, correct?
Well,
I mean,
no.
how, the idea for preservation is to put the trial court on notice of what you're.
Sure.
So if I go and I read these pages, will I be confused as to whether or not there was evidence for an instruction, or will it be clear to me that you think there wasn't evidence to submit the claim?
Well, the court will have to draw its own judgment. That's what it said. The best I have is to use the term submissibility. But let me draw your attention to this other point, and that is we have inconsistent verdicts because you have nominal damages on a claim that requires actual damages, and then the jury awards punitive damages. And Marquis Financial Services of Indiana versus Pete, which I did cite in the brief, 365 Southwest 3rd, 256 at page 261 to 262, says you do not need to make a motion for a directed verdict at the close of all the evidence to address this issue, because when you have inconsistent verdicts, that issue doesn't arise until after the verdicts are entered, and then the proper motion is a motion for JNOV. And we did file that, and we did raise this point in the motion in that way. So at our worst case scenarios, you know, I think we've got some nominal damages, but it's the $2.8 million in punitives are still properly before this court.
Thank you, Counselor. You got an extra minute from the court over there.
The case is
your time is up.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice,
yes.
Could you ask them to submit?
Right. So to the extent that either of you mentioned cases during oral argument that aren't in your brief, please direct a letter to the court clerk and copy your opposing counsel with those citations. Thank you.